I am back in the Coast to Coast AM air chair tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning. And in the first hour, America's first conspiracy, the plot to kill General George Washington. And then we'll learn about the Copper Scroll, which was discovered in the caves of Qumran in Israel's West Bank back in 1952 amidst the other Dead Sea Scrolls. Is it a treasure map? Does it lead to the unimaginable treasures of Solomon's first temple? And perhaps even the Ark of the Covenant? That's tonight with yours truly on Coast to Coast AM. Back with more of my conversation with Andrew Collins. And we'll connect the dots between the Denisovans and Göbekli Tepe right here on Coast to Coast AM. Andrew Collins stays with us, the author of The Cygnus Key, The Denisovan Legacy, Göbekli Tepe, and the Birth of Egypt. Will also take your questions and comments. Andrew, if we look at Göbekli Tepe, have we found symbols of the swan there that would connect it directly with the Denisovans?
The symbol of the swan is a symbol of Cygnus. The Cygnus was seen as a different type of bird in different parts of the world. I mean, in America, for instance, not only was it associated with the swan, but also with the eagle and the hawk. But in Southwest Asia, in the area of Göbekli Tepe, the bird that was associated with the Cygnus constellation and with the soul becoming a bird and entering into the next world was the vulture. So instead of the swan at Göbekli Tepe, we have the vulture. And this is a symbol that's very prominent on the stones, has been found as, sculptures, and generally always in association with a human skull. And the human skull is the symbol of the soul, just as it is in Native American tradition. It's believed that the soul resided in the head, and that, when the soul was released from the body, the symbol that was used for it, was either, a head or a skull or even just a circle with a couple of eyes or something like that. And that's exactly what we got at Göbekli Tepe. And there's a very famous stone there known as the Vulture Stone or Pillar 43. And this is in the north-northwestern section of the oldest and most sophisticated enclosure there, which is Enclosure D. Now, Enclosure D, the axis of it is aligned perfectly to the setting of the bright star Deneb in the constellation of Cygnus. And the actual vulture on this stone, which is next to this alignment, is a perfect representation of the Cygnus constellation around 9500 BC, which is the exact time frame of the construction of this enclosure.
So, was Göbekli Tepe built by the Denisovans or their descendants?
It was built by their descendants, I think. And although today there is no noticeable Denisovan DNA anywhere west of Central Asia, almost certainly it would have been there in the past. For instance, a lot of our earliest ancestors that came into Europe had actually come all the way from Siberia, the Altai Mountains, the Ural Mountains, gradually making their way into Western Europe, down into what's known as Anatolia, obviously modern-day Turkey. And they would have been carrying with them the Denisovan ancestry and, of course, the Denisovan legacy. In other words, all of their technology, their culture, their cosmology, and their ideas. And so these would have reached Göbekli Tepe. And this is not just speculation. We can see almost like a paper trail caused through the stone tools and the very specific means of manufacture of the different tools that originate in the area of the Altai Mountains of southern Siberia 40,000 to 50,000 years ago, and very slowly are dying. Fused all the way across until they eventually go down between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea across the Caucasus Mountains down into what is today modern-day Turkey. We can see it. It's a very specific route. It's acknowledged by archaeologists, and almost certainly the peoples that brought these ideas, brought these stone tools into Turkey, inspired the creation of Göbekli Tepe around 9500 BC. I mean, even Professor Klaus Schmidt, the famous archaeologist that discovered Göbekli Tepe, believed that those that were responsible for the manufacture of Göbekli Tepe came in from the north, most likely from Russia, which is exactly the path that they would have taken through Russia, along what's known as the Russian Steppe, down, as I said, across the Caucasus into Anatolia, modern-day southeast Turkey.
But doesn't Orthodox anthropology tell us that 11,000 years ago, man was, you know, nomadic, and we were basically hunter-gatherers? How would such large groups of people been organized into, let's say, you know, labor parties that would have been necessary to construct something like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, something big happened around 11 to 12,000 years ago. We started to create what's known as monumental architecture for the first time. It's seen at Göbekli Tepe. It may well be there at other parts of the world, places like Gedung Budang in Java, which is this huge pyramid hill structure there. And even at Stonehenge, I mean, the earliest faces of Stonehenge go back to 8,000 BC. And something happened around this time. And what was it? Well, the fact is that there'd been a huge cataclysm that devastated the world around 10,800 BC, triggering a whole series of other events, including a mini ice age, wildfires that had burned for many hundreds of years, probably tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and almost certainly this was triggered by a comet impact. This seems to be pretty well recognized. At the beginning of last year, there were two massive papers in Geology magazine, citing every possible piece of evidence showing that this cosmic cataclysm actually took place. And this would have absolutely devastated the world, particularly North America, where it would seem that the greatest impact of pieces, devastated the North American landmass. And this had an impact, not only on the devastation of human populations, possibly as much as 75% was devastated at this time. But beyond that is the fact that people lived in fear that these cataclysms would return. And I think that what they did was they turned to their shamans and said, look, you're the only people we can turn to. What can we do about this? And they said, look, just follow our instructions and we will make certain that the supernatural creatures that cause these cataclysms, never return. And I think that this involved the creation of these monuments, these enclosures, the earliest stone circles, the earliest megalithic architecture, the earliest monumental architecture anywhere in the world. In other words, that they super suddenly started to supersize everything, in the belief that by creating these monuments that allowed them easy access to the sky world, the easy access through these virtual stargates, if you like, of access into the realms where they could deal with these supernatural creatures that they thought were responsible for these cataclysms, that this would make it right. And this is exactly as what we see in the myths and legends around the world. Obviously, we know about the story of the great flood of the Bible. Well, of course, what was one of the first things that Noah does after the great flood? He creates the first altar. And you find this again and again in these flood myths, these disaster myths, that those that survive, the first thing that they do is create the first temple or the first altar, to try and appease the gods, to say, look, we've survived this, please don't ever do this again. And I think that this is a memory of this cataclysm and the response to this. And this, in many ways, kick-started our civilization, our material civilization. But prior to this time, you are right, of course, there were only so-called hunter-gatherers, people that did their own thing, you know, they looked after their family, their immediate social, you know, world. But they were united through their cosmology and their ideas, their technology. It's what I call the shamanic civilization. It's a different type of civilization. It wasn't one that was bound through roads and cities and towns, but through beliefs and ideas and a state of mind.
What about human sacrifice? Where did that come from? I mean, is there any link to the Denisovans and human sacrifice?
We don't know. It's a difficult one. I mean, the one thing that we can say at the moment is that a number of these stories to do with the giants is that they were cannibalistic, which therefore does suggest that you know, I hesitate to use the word sacrifice, but that death would occur and that, you know, that people would be ate. But whether this was by the Denisovans or some of their more degenerate hybrid descendants is very, very difficult. Certainly the archaeology doesn't give us anything to suggest that this is something that took place. There is some slight evidence that the Neanderthals may have been cannibalistic, but many of our own ancestors were cannibalistic. You know, even the Anasazi, you know, in North America, there's evidence that they were cannibalistic, but we don't know in what way this was used, whether it was to create a fear within society, or whether it was simply that if some great ancestor, you know, or sorry, some great person, you know, died within the community, people would, you know, share some part of their body, so that they would take in, you know, this ancestorship that could be passed on from generation to generation. So it's a very difficult one. And certainly for places like Göbekli Tepe, there's no evidence at all that human sacrifices ever took place.
Are you ready to take some calls, Andrew?
That'd be great, yeah.
All right, let's start with Barry in South Carolina. Barry, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hi there, Richard. What a great program tonight. And I really mean that. And keep up the good work. I can't wait to hear tonight, Sunday night show with you on. And anyway, for Frederick, thank you so much for this information. You're talking about my favorite subject, Göbekli Tepe. Jimmy Church and I talk about it each time I talk with him on Coast to Coast. And my question is, we know already that Göbekli Tepe is approximately 12,500 years old, which is 800 or 900 years older than they thought any place was. But do you think the descendants of Göbekli Tepe could have had something to do with the killing of Jesus Christ in Israel and so forth? And thanks, guys. Keep up the great work, Richard.
All right, Barry, thank you for that. I'm not quite following the dots there, Andrew. Would Göbekli Tepe have to do with the crucifixion?
Directly, probably very little, but what it does bring us into is, you know, the people of Göbekli Tepe, even if they did come from the north, which is what we suggest is the case, you know, what was the relationship with the area that is today Israel or Palestine? And the fact is that there was a relationship between Egypt all the way up into southeast Anatolia, you know, modern-day Turkey, from at least 10 to 12,000 years ago, you know, the very time of Göbekli Tepe. And what you find is that the stone tools that were manufactured at Göbekli Tepe gradually find their way all the way into Egypt. There's a particular type of stone tool known as the Helwan Point. It's a very specific type of arrowhead. And you can trace its progress from the area of Göbekli Tepe all the way right within the sites of the Great Pyramid. And I'm pretty certain that the influence of Göbekli Tepe came into Egypt and inspired the creation of the Great Pyramids, which is why both at Giza, the three pyramids there are aligned to sickness in exactly the same way as the main enclosures at Göbekli Tepe are aligned to exactly the same star in exactly the same manner. This cannot be coincidence. And when you start looking at this, you start finding these same alignments towards Cygnus are found all over the world. They're there within Native American mound complexes, for instance. My colleague Greg Little has done incredible work examining the archaeoastronomy, the alignments at various of these Adena period, Hopewell period mound complexes, and they are also aligned to Cygnus. And earlier you talked about Orion. You said that, yes, you've heard about the idea that Orion is linked to Giza, but you've never heard about Cygnus. Well, Cygnus is the other half of the story, because what we find is that there was an ancient death journey that was universal around the world, and it basically begins with this leap of faith towards the constellation of Orion. And at that point, you pick up the Milky Way, and you then travel from Orion around to the Cygnus constellation, which is where the Milky Way splits in two. And at this point, you will be judged, your soul will be judged, and it will either be then allowed to go into the afterlife, or it will either be cast into oblivion or allowed to reincarnate. And that point of entry into the afterlife was the Cygnus constellation, and that's universal. So in other words, with Orion, we've only had half the story. We've now got the other half of the story. And I think that my colleague Graham Hancock will have something to say about this in his new book, America Before, which is published in April, which will also be covering a lot of area of the Denisovans as well. And I'm sure you may well be talking to him about some of these subjects, which I'm introducing to you, but will soon become mainstream.
You're providing a sensational primer, Andrew, to be sure. One of the things, we're heading into a break here, but very quickly, one of the things that's always confused me is when we're talking about the alignment of ancient sites, whether it's Göbekli Tepe or the Pyramids of Giza or Stonehenge, how do they figure that out, which constellations they're aligned to? Because we have this precession of the equinox and the constellations, but also the possibility of pole shifts, which would totally sort of muddy the water, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah, but there's no evidence of a massive pole shift, certainly in the last 17,000 years. I mean, in the past, before that, perhaps, perhaps there may have been shifts. But in the lead-up to the creation of our own civilization, there's nothing that suggests that our monuments, like Göbekli Tepe or other similar monuments around the world, have shifted their positions in any particular way. In other words, they're not several degrees off north because of some shift in the poles. That just doesn't seem to have been the case, because they are accurately aligned to the stars that they seem to be focused upon in the time frame of their construction. This seems to be, pretty well accepted. But quite clearly, things like precession and the movement of the stars on the horizon, yes, of course.
All right, Andrew, we'll pick up on that point. We'll pick up on that point when we come back. And we'll also take your questions and comments. Andrew Collins, author of The Cygnus Key, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And if you like what you're hearing tonight, this morning, you might wish to check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. And it airs live Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern here in Toronto on Zoomer Radio and in delay on about 40 affiliates across North America. For more information and a list of affiliates, visit my website, strangeplanet.ca. Strangeplanet.ca. And you might want to check out my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Listen and subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Hey, and don't forget to say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Back with more of my conversation with Andrew Collins as we continue to delve into the Cygnus Key and the Denisovan legacy, Göbekli Tepe and the birth of Egypt, plus your questions and comments, all right here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, let's go right to the phones and say hello to Mayad on the wildcard line. She's checking in from New York. Mayad, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Very, very interesting program. I have a three-parter, and then I want to tune in to have to do the internet in New York tonight to listen. First, Andrew, I want you to clarify the origin of the name Denisovans and also the spelling. And secondly, I'd like to know, I believe if I'm correct, that Neanderthals only show up in a small percentage in the European and Asian population. If you could give some understanding of that, where they fit in, how and when, as to the, and how it fits into your overall view. And lastly, Stephen Quayle has also been dealing with the Giants. I'd like to know if you're familiar with his work. I have a book with the cover. It's just unbelievable in terms of an example of one of the Giants. And whether you've looked at his work and how you look at it, whether it jives or whether he has that particular piece, how would you analyze his work in conjunction with yours? And if you have my questions, Andrew, I'll turn on the internet and I'll listen to your responses.
Thank you, Mayad. Yeah. All right,
yeah,
Andrew.
Good questions there. Firstly, I'll be honest, I'm not aware of Stephen Quayle's work. Sounds interesting. I'll look into it. Obviously, you can send me a link or give me the details. But there are a number of books, obviously, on the Giants of America, particularly associated with the giant skeletons. I mean, my colleague Greg Little has done a lot of work on it. My colleagues, Hugh Newman, Jim Vieira, Ross Hamilton, you know, various other people have done some really sterling work to record literally thousands of accounts of the discovery of giant skeletons in Native American context. And there's some great books out there at this time. But coming on to the Denisovans quite specifically, I mean, their name is obviously taken from the cave. That's the Denisova cave. And that actually comes from a hermit who occupied that cave in the 18th century called Denis, or Denis. And from that, the cave got its name, Denisova. And the correct pronunciation, and obviously there are two ways of pronouncing it that certainly have come into popular tradition, but the original and the correct way of pronouncing Denisovans is, as I just said, Denisovans. This was what was decided by the geneticists at the Max Planck Institute of Physical Anthropology at Leipzig in Germany, when they first realized the uniqueness of the genome of this particular bone that they'd found in the Denisova cave. So they called them the Denisovans, basically. But obviously, some of my colleagues call them Denisovans. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's like tomato and tomato, isn't it, at the end of the day? So that's that. As to the relationship of the DNA, now, there is no Denisovan DNA in Europeans. The only Europeans that have any Denisovan DNA are the Finnish people, and that's because of their background in Asia. Up to 6 to 7% of Finnish DNA comes across from northern Asia via the top of the Ural Mountains, which divide Europe from Asia. Many different populations from Central Asia going into Eastern Asia, in China, for instance, Japan, Vietnam, Cambodia, places like this, have up to 5 to 6% Denisovan DNA. That's quite a lot. That definitely shows us that the that the hybrid descendants of the Denisovans mostly moved in the east. In other words, you know, as they were coming out of Africa and they encountered the Denisovans, once they'd interbred with them, their descendants continued the journey eastwards. So that's that. But as far as so we got Neanderthal DNA, yes, most people that came out of Africa, in fact, I would say all people that came out of Africa from as early as 200,000 years ago through until about 30,000 years ago gained Neanderthal DNA, and that is still within us today. There's up to 2%. And as far as Africa itself is concerned, this is where the Denisovans began, as this other much earlier type of human known as Homo heidelbergensis. And when their bones are found in Africa, they are anything up to 7 to 7.5 feet tall. They would seem to have been the precursors of the Denisovans. In fact, there is even a possibility that the Denisovans are Homo heidelbergensis. And we first know about them. They were also in Europe, by the way. We first know about them from a jaw that was found at Heidelberg in Germany in, I think it was either 1907 or 1908, at a place called Mauer. And this jaw is absolutely massive. The teeth in it are massive, and they match very well the size of the teeth of the Denisovans found in the Denisova cave, or Denisova cave. So, you know, everything tends to suggest that the Denisovans were of massive size. And if you want an impression of how they looked, look up the great Kali. He's an Indian wrestler. He's 7 feet tall in height, you know, built massively. And, yeah, he's got a very long face, very long jaw. I mean, have a look at him. I would say if I wanted to say, yeah, what a Denisovan look like, I would point towards him and say he looks very similar to what they would look like.
What about, is there any connection between the Denisovans and perhaps the elongated skulls in Peru?
Probably not directly, because the elongated skulls don't come from the Denisovans, they come from the Neanderthals. The Neanderthals had extremely long skulls. In fact, so long that often the natural forming Neanderthal skulls were mistakenly thought to be artificially deformed. And the reason why they had elongated skulls is that they had a much larger cerebellum, which is a part of the brain right at the back, you know, just above the spinal cord. And this is an area that is associated with dreams and visions and, you know, experiences which, you know, we would more associate with, you know, more artistic, creative ideas today. And this elongated skull would seem to have been inherited by the earliest Neanderthal hybrids. But of course, obviously, there were also Neanderthal-Denisovan hybrids. In fact, only last year it was announced that a first-generation Neanderthal-Denisovan hybrid, the bones of which had been found in the Denisova cave. So, you know, there's this incredible admixture of these early archaic humans, and we come into the mix. So, you know, you create the Neanderthal, Denisovan, human mixes. So this is creating all people of different sizes with different shaped heads and whatever, and all of them have their own unique characteristics and features, and I believe that most of the long-headed nature comes from Neanderthal ancestry, not from Denisovans. But of course, some Denisovan hybrids would have also had Neanderthal ancestry as well, so they also would have had long heads as well.
East of the Rockies, Joe is in Long Island. Good morning, Joe. Welcome to Coast.
Yeah, hi, Andrew. I'm speculating, but say a Pacific island, say a Hawaii, if they had remnants of these people from way back when, how could they have possibly gotten there? Could they have domesticated birds and traveled on birds, giant birds? And were the watchmen dispersed as individuals where they could have been, say, on one of these islands rather than together as a group?
Well, it's a very interesting thing, and this is an area that I'll be covering with Greg Little in the new book, The Nisselan Origins, that's coming out in September, because there is a lot of evidence of Denisovan DNA in South America. And this seems to be connected with ancestry of Melanesian and Australian origin. And you have to say to yourself, how did this get into South America? And there are no absolute hard and fast answers, but it does look very likely that there were Denisovan hybrids in Southeast Asia, island Southeast Asia, places like Indonesia, and that some kind of maritime expeditions went on between there, probably the north coast of Australia, round to New Zealand, and then down using the currents and the different winds that would take them all the way down to Antarctica, and then across up into South America, right in the tip of South America, allowing them to go up even the west coast of South America or the east coast, where they would have been able to enter the interior of South America through the different navigable rivers. And this could be the explanation why we find quite high levels of both Australian and Melanesian DNA in South America, as well as Denisovan DNA. And what Greg and myself will be showing in the new book is that there was extreme high culture in South America, certainly by 4,000 years ago, but that the DNA suggests that the Denisovans may well have been in South America by about 40 to 50,000 years ago. And what this means is that in addition to all the incredible high culture that we know that they had, they were also ancient mariners as well.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Let's say hi to Tom on the wildcard line. He's in Cerritos, California. Tom, good morning.
Hey, Richard, you like Stephen Wright things too, right? I got one for you real quick.
I love Stephen Wright. What do you got?
I'd kill for a Nobel Peace Prize. That's my favorite, Stephen Wright.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and also I was at a hotel that had the pool was on the 20th floor. I tried to swim to the bottom, but it was 200 feet deep. Anyway,
okay.
I wanted to ask you two things. How is it that how did the Neanderthals get overcome by, you know, what caused all that? And second of all, based on the maritime thing, I've read that back in those days, a lot of the earth was encased in ice, and the distances in water were not as distinct, you know, not as long. It made it easier for them to travel around. And also, were the Egyptians involved in any of this as well? That's one of, you know, if you can answer at least two of those three questions or just respond to them.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for the Stephen Wright jokes.
Well, I mean, the maritime one to do with the ice, yes, absolutely. I mean, the Ice Age has caused huge amounts of ice to build up in the oceans, in particular the Atlantic. And this would have made navigation between Europe and North America not easy, but possible. And this, again, is something that, you know, Greg and I are going to look at in the new book, The Nisselan Origins, that comes out, because what we see is that there was a huge flowering of civilization going on in southern Siberia and the Altai Mountains around 40 to 50,000 years ago, when our own ancestors first encounter the Denisovans. But, you know, within about 10,000 years, the pure Denisovans, you know, in other words, those with 100% DNA of, you know, their own, you know, type of humans, disappear, and all that's left is the hybrid descendants. So in other words, somehow the Denisovans have disappeared. So what happened to them? Well, we might ask the same question, of course, to the Neanderthals. They disappear around the same time. Well, it's actually probably about 30,000 years ago that the Neanderthals disappear in Europe and in Western and in Central Asia. So what happened to them? Well, nobody really knows. It may be to do with the changing environment towards the Ice Age, although this seems to be unlikely, because both the Denisovans and the Neanderthals had been around for hundreds of thousands of years, survived many different ice ages. And I think the most likely explanation is it's got something to do with us, you know, our own ancestors. I get the feeling that the meetings between ourselves and both the Denisovans and the Neanderthals probably did not go well. I mean, you know, what happened when Europeans first encountered the peoples of the Americas? That didn't go well either. And I think that there are traditions that, you know, you can cite from different periods of history where a new, different type of culture encounters one that's been existing for an extremely long period of time. Those encounters, to start with, never go well. And I think that the same might be said between our own ancestors encountering Denisovans and Neanderthals for the first time. And the third part of the question about the link with Egypt is, well, obviously dynastic Egypt begins around 3000 BC. So that's quite late on in the day. So there's no direct link with Denisovans. But if you start looking at the technology, the geometry, the mathematics of the Great Pyramid, you start to realize that this couldn't possibly have all originated on the spot in Egypt, which obviously prompts the theories about Atlantis, about aliens. But I would say that the geometry and mathematics of the Great Pyramid almost certainly is a legacy of the Denisovans, because the very same numbers like 216, 108, 432, which we find in association with the mathematics and geometry at Giza, is found universally around the world. As I said, it's in Southeast Asia, it's in India, Mesopotamia, Northern Europe, China, in Java. And these same numbers crop up again and again and again. 108, 216, 432. And you can trace the origins of these all the way back to southern Siberia, at least 24,000 years ago. And I firmly believe that they originated with the autistic mindset of the Denisovans going back at least 40 to 50,000 years ago. And at this time, the earliest cosmologies were being created. And the central key figure associated with this was the swan, the symbol of the Cygnus constellation around that
Andrew,
time. And that, of course, is why I call the book Cygnus Key.
Can't wait to the second installment on this subject, the Denisovan legacy. Andrew Collins in the UK, thank you so much for hanging out for 2 hours.
Yep, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Richard.
For George Noy, George Naples Alliance, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Chris Burrows, Mike Cozio, Donna Walker, Sean Latasore, and here in Toronto, Mike Ben Dixon, Robert Turner, Patrick O'Neill, and in Brantford, Scott Guitar Flicks. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until tonight, so long for now.